You are listening to Radio I, your source for printed news and information. This service is intended for listeners who are blind, visually impaired, or have other disabilities that prevent them from reading. All materials are read as written and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Radio I. For further information about this service, please call 859-422-6390 or visit our website at www.radioi.org. That's www.radioeye.org.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the reading of the Courier-Journal for this Monday, May 22nd, which is brought to our Louisville listeners via Louisville Public Media. And as you know, Radio I is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Your reader for today is Rod Brotherton. Let's take a look at the weather, and you're going to like this forecast. All week, it reads sunny and warm, mostly sunny and warm, sunny and warm. Let's take a look. Today, high 82, partly sunny and pleasant. Tonight, low 59, clear to partly cloudy. Tuesday, mostly sunny and warm. High 85, low 63. Wednesday, mostly sunny and warm. High 86, low 64. Thursday, mostly sunny and warm. High 78, low 56. Friday, it's just mostly sunny. High 78, low 58. And guess what? Saturday, just one word. Sunny. Great. High 80, low 65. Get out there and enjoy it if you can. Let's take a look at the almanac. Yesterday's high and low, 77 and 66, compared with a normal of 78 and 60. Record high was 93 in 1951. Record low, 35 in 2002. On Friday, there was just a trace of precipitation, which means month to date, we've had 3.18 compared with a normal of 3.4. Year to date, we've had 21.02 inches compared with a normal of 19.6. For the sun and the moon, the sun rose this morning at 6:27. It will set at 8:53. The moon came up a few minutes ago at 8:27 a.m. There will be no moon set. And in weather history, on May 22nd, 1804, a tornado ripped through New Brunswick, New Jersey. A hotel, two barns, and three houses were destroyed. But most tornadoes in the U.S. hit areas from the Central Plains up through the Ohio Valley. All right, let's take a look at the headlines. There are three stories on the front page today, and number one being JCPS board members debate a raise for Pollo. He's been Jefferson County's public school superintendent for 4 years and worked as an educator within the district for nearly three decades. Now, JCPS Superintendent Marty Pollo, who has steered the district through significant changes amid persistent scrutiny, could retire and make roughly the same amount of money as his current annual salary base of $276,000. And while Pollo says he doesn't plan to retire next year, the fact that he could make as much either way is a concern to at least one member of the JCPS Board of School Districts. Chris Kolb, who represents District 2, said he hopes a salary increase will be discussed Tuesday night when the seven-member board discusses Podio's performance in executive session. His position is already the highest paid in the district, and the state's largest with the approximately 96,000 students and 17,000 employees. And in the past, Pollo has turned down bonuses and a pay hike, Kolb said, but I've been trying to get him to accept a pretty significant increase. Pollo told the Courier-Journal in an interview that he has thought about a raise, saying, "I think that's something I will discuss with our board." But he continued, For me, it clearly is a challenge when you work in a public school system and you want to provide all of the employees with the benefits and compensation that they deserve as well. In arguing Pollo should get a raise, Kolb pointed to the fact that the district's chief academic officer position, among the system's top position, went unfilled about 8 months. I heard one of the factors, that he had a hard time getting people to apply for the position because people thought he wouldn't be around much longer and because why would we work for free, Kolb said. It could help people realize if you intend to stay, if your salary goes up, he said, he told Polio. Polio has been paying into the state teachers' retirement system since his JCPS career began 29 years ago. There are many factors that would dictate the exact dollar figure he could draw from his pension annually, such as the benefits he might have opted into or how many saved sick days he can cash in. But Polio's annual draw can initially be formulated by calculating the average of the 5 years of his highest salary according to the system's handbook. Hired as superintendent in 2018, Polio has been paid $276,000 each year since, and next year will mark his fifth year at that rate. That annual rate of pay for a superintendent of a large urban school is not unusual. The superintendents within the Council of the Great City Schools, which is comprised of 78 large urban school districts across the country, had an average salary of $276,781 as of November 2022, according to the organization. Within Kentucky, Fayette County Superintendent Demetrius Liggins, who serves a district with about 40,000 students, earns slightly less than Polio at $275,000. But when monthly vehicle stipends are factored in, Polio gets $750 a month for that. Liggins actually earns about $2,000 more. Meanwhile, when looking at the length of service for superintendents, Polio's time in the position is slightly unusual. Of the 78 in the council, only 10 superintendents have a longer tenure than Polio's. A 2018 report cited the average tenure of a superintendent of a large district as 5 to 6 years, but there has been a noticeable uptick in superintendents leaving their roles the past few years, with some citing burnout from navigating COVID-19 or increased public discord facing schools. Within Kentucky, the average length of service for Kentucky superintendents was just over 4 years at the beginning of the 21-22 school year, according to an article published by the Kentucky School Boards Association. That article also says research shows whole district student achievement is influenced by continuity in leadership. The need to retain effective superintendents is apparent, especially in historically low-achieving districts, it says. Stability in the position also has a positive effect on employee morale, community support, and the efficiency or the efficacy of daily district operations. When asked why he would continue working given his pay situation, Polio chuckled and said, I don't know, I don't have any idea. He did, however, point to the goals his team identified through its future state strategic plan and how those were put on hold for years. Prior to the pandemic, district leaders went to the drawing board to reimagine the school system with the question in mind, what's stopping JCPS from getting the outcomes we need for kids, Polio said earlier this year. What they came up with was 6 areas to focus on, guided by the principles of increasing racial equity, increasing engagement, and improving climate and culture. The focus areas included technology, extended learning, student assignment, facilities, workforce and leadership development, and resourcing high-poverty schools. Now many of those plans have been put into action. Changes coming this fall include a new student assignment plan, new funding formula, new start times, and a new reading curriculum. I feel a responsibility to ensure that they are successful, a As we implement those over the next year or two, Polio said about why he doesn't plan to retire next year. Polio also pointed to the research showing student outcomes improve when the district leadership prevails. There continues to be a significant amount of turnover in superintendents across America, especially in large districts, and I think that is extremely negative for student outcomes, he said. I think the districts we've seen be successful have had continuity of leadership in order to get those outcomes. That's what I want and hope to see here, that we reap the benefits for students in all of the changes that we have made. That's the number one thing I continue to focus on. Story: baby steps taken on gardens, remediation work scheduled on the project. Tony Guanci remembers first tutoring the historic Louisville garden space years ago. The space itself was memorable, as was the cut he got on his leg from a nail while walking through the armory-turned-entertainment venue. The entrepreneur jokes that the TG lettering on the front of the building stands for his name. But he knows the storied downtown buildings belong to no one person and holds a special place in the memories of many. "I am very aware of how important this building is," he said. "If you ask anybody about the gardens, everybody has a story. It's a high school graduation, or I saw Elvis, or I saw whoever, and I feel an obligation to do something really important and to do it right." Guanci, along with Scott Hodgkins, is working on a plan to revive the 1905 space with an anticipated minimum investment of $60 million. Their proposal to redevelop the venue into film and television production space made a splash in December 2022 at a news conference. Since then, the site hasn't made much progress. That's about to change with environmental remediation work scheduled to start in early June. "You may not have seen any physical work being done, but there is work," Guanci said. "We're peeling back the onion." Part of envisioning what can be is getting a better understanding of original structure plans. The nearly 120-year-old building has a number of past lives, from its time as the Jefferson County Armory to a 6,000-seat venue that saw the likes of Martin Luther King Jr. to Harry S. Truman and a performance by Elvis Presley. In order for us to come in and really understand what we can do, we need to go back and find out what really exists, Guanci said. "We've got a number of engineers and architects and general contractors that are collecting data, looking at it, and then we have to decide how do we take what we know exists and can we build that we hope we can build the inside it." Plans call for the conversion of the arena at Muhammad Ali Boulevard and Fifth Street into a hub with sound stages for film, music, and digital production, totaling 40,000 square feet of production space. Feasibility work includes exploring the building's foundation, floor, subfloor, and other structural elements. Louisville Metro Government owns the property and signed a letter of intent with River City Entertainment Group, LLC, of which Guanci and Hodgkins are principals, in December 2022. The letter gives the developers until early June 2023 to conduct the work it needs to flesh out the structural and financial details of its plan, leading to the signing of a formal development agreement, though this period can be extended. Caitlin Bowling, spokeswoman for the city's Economic Development Cabinet, told the Courier-Journal the developers are seeking an extension. Meanwhile, work is expected to begin June 5th to clean up lead dust, asbestos, and suspected lead-based paint at the site, Bowling said. The nearly $1.4 million effort by California-based Tetra Tech, Inc. will be paid by the city through the Brownfield Cleanup Revolving Loan Fund. Tetra Tech previously performed environmental assessments on the building and did remediation work at the venue in 2018 focused on contaminants in hydraulic systems. As planning continues on the Louisville project, Guanche is far into development on a different studio project in Southern California. Silmar Studios, a $500 million, 300,000 square foot film and television production facility, is being built in the city of Silmar, a northern neighborhood of Los Angeles, about 20 miles northwest of Hollywood. Guanche said the project includes about 16 sound stages, office space, a backlot, and mills for sets, props, and other creations. Construction began in 2022 at the studio, the first phase of which is expected to open in early 2024. Film production facilities are a newer venture for Guanche, a veteran in the real estate, music, and sporting industries. While he's a California resident, his cell phone still has a Las Vegas area code from his more than 20 years working as a partner with the Maloof family, which at one time owned the Palms Casino and the Sacramento Kings. While the two projects share the same function, Louisville's proposed production hub would be a smaller operation than the Silmar development. In California, there will be 120,000 square feet of production's office space, while Louisville's project would have 40,000. 16 stages are planned in Silmar, 4 are envisioned for Louisville. Silmar stages would receive 4 times the amperage than Louisville's. Well, that's mainly because the sets, the lighting, the level that they would need to shoot something in Louisville would be totally different than something that, you know, Steven Spielberg wants to shoot, and you have your stages in California, Guanche said. While the California stages would have catwalks and lifts and be outfitted to host large television show audiences, anticipated needs different are for Louisville and would inform what is built here. Green screens, for example, are commonplace in Los Angeles and won't be part of a Silmar, Guanche said, while they would be in Louisville. He said he can see Louisville's studios being utilized for commercial shoots, television films, and any number of possibilities from local creators. A unique part of the Louisville plan, a training facility in Louisville for production careers on the block to the west of the Louisville Gardens, with the goal of strengthening the pipeline of local talent. If we can adaptively come up with something that not only gives the city this building back, but brings the state and the city a new industry, a new set of jobs, a new workforce, I think it's a win-win, Guanche said. And I think the community will see that and know that we are not carpetbaggers from California or from wherever, you know, and that we have a real love and a passion to make this work for Louisville. Finally, on the front page, GOP White House face key differences in the debt talks. Debt limit talks between the White House and House Republicans stopped, started, and stopped again Friday at the U.S. Capitol, a dizzying series of events in high-stakes negotiations to avoid a potential catastrophic federal default. President Biden's administration is reaching for a deal with Republicans led by House Speaker Kevin McCarthy as the nation faces a deadline as soon as June 1st to raise the country's borrowing limit, now at a staggering $31 trillion, to keep paying the nation's bills. Republicans are demanding steep spending cuts, and the Democrats oppose. Negotiations came to an abrupt standstill earlier in the day when McCarthy said it's time to pause talks. But the negotiation teams convened again in the evening only to quickly call it quits for the night. Biden, attending a Group of Seven summit in Japan, continued to express optimism that an agreement will be reached, saying that negotiation happens in stages. I believe we'll be able to avoid a default and get something done, he said. His press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, earlier had acknowledged the difficulty of the talks.
There's no questions. We have serious differences, she said,
without outlining any of them. Top Republican negotiators for McCarthy said after the evening session that they were uncertain on next steps, though it's likely discussions will resume over the weekend, the White House said publicly and expressed optimism that a resolution could be reached if parties negotiated in good faith. We re-engaged, had very, very candid discussions, talking about where we are, talking about where things need to be. That's reasonably acceptable, said Representative Garrett Graves, Republican of Louisiana, a top McCarthy ally, leading the talks for his side. Another Republican negotiator, Representative Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, was asked if he was confident an agreement over budget issues could be reached at the White House. He replied, no. As the White House team left the nighttime session, counselor to the president, Stephen Ricchetti, who is leading talks for the Democrats, said he was hopeful.
We're going to keep working, he said.
Biden had already planned to cut short the rest of his trip and is expected to return to Washington on Sunday night. Earlier in the day, McCarthy said resolution to the standoff is easy if only Biden's team would agree to some spending cuts Republicans are demanding. The biggest impasse was over the fiscal 2024 top-line budget account, according to a person briefed on the talks and granted an anonymity to discuss them. Democrats staunchly oppose the steep reductions Republicans have put on the table as potentially harmful to Americans and are insisting that Republicans agree to tax hikes on the wealthy in addition to spending cuts to close the deficit. We've got to get movement by the White House, and we don't have any movement yet, McCarthy, Republican of California, told reporters at the Capitol. So, yeah, we got to pause. White House Communications Director Ben LaBolt said Saturday that any serious negotiations on the budget must include discussions both of spending and of revenue. But Republicans have refused to discuss revenue. He added, President Biden will not accept a wish list of extreme MAGA priorities that would punish the middle class and the neediest Americans and set our economic progress back. Jean-Pierre insisted Biden was not negotiating on raising the borrowing limit, despite the clear link in talks between securing a budget deal and raising the debt ceiling.
It's not negotiable. We should not be negotiating on the debt, she said.
Wall Street turned lower as negotiations came to a sudden halt. Experts have warned that even the threat of a debt default would spark a recession. Republicans argue that the nation's deficit spending needs to get under control, aiming to roll back spending to fiscal 2022 levels and restrict future growth. But Biden's team is countering that the caps Republicans proposed in their House-passed bill would amount to a 30% reduction in some programs if military and veteran spending are spared, according to a memo from the Office of Management and Budget. Any deal would need the support of both Republicans and Democrats to find approval in a divided Congress and be passed into law. Negotiators are eyeing a more narrow budget cap deal of a few years rather than the decade-long caps Republicans initially wanted, and clawing back some of the $30 billion of unspent COVID-19 funds. Still up for debate are policy changes, including a framework for permitting reforms to speed the development of energy projects, as well as the Republican push to impose work requirements of government aid recipients that Biden has been open to, but the House Democrat leader, Hakeem Jeffries, has said was a non-starter. Look, we can't be spending any more money next year, McCarthy said at the Capitol. We have to spend less than we spent the year before. It's pretty easy. McCarthy faces pressure from his hard right flank to cut the strongest deal possible for Republicans. And he risks a threat to his leadership as Speaker if he fails to deliver. Many House Republicans are unlikely to accept any deal with the White House. The internal political dynamics confronting the embattled McCarthy leave the Democrats skeptical about giving away too much to the Republicans and driving off the support they will need to pass any compromise through Congress. Biden is facing increased pushback from Democrats, particularly progressives, who argue the reductions will fall too heavily on domestic programs that Americans rely on. Next, pain is the most common chronic ailment in the U.S. Pain is the most common chronic ailment in the U.S. by far, a new study finds, and people in pain tend to stay in pain over the course of a year. The study, published last week in the JAMA Network Open, compared the pain scores of more than 10,000 people from 2019 to 2020. Pain was found to be far more common than other chronic diseases. If 1,000 people were measured for a year, the study said, there would be 52 cases of chronic pain, 45 cases of high blood pressure, 16 cases of depression, and 7 cases of diabetes. Volunteers were asked several questions. In the past 3 months, how often did you have pain? Would you say never, some days, most days, or every day? And over the last 3 months, how often did pain limit your life or work activities? Would you say never, some days, most days, or every day? At the start, about 40% reported no pain, about the same percentage reported some pain, and more than 20% reported chronic pain suffering for at least the past 3 months. In some cases, people recovered over the following year, while for others, the pain progressed. Nearly 15% of those with some pain in 2019 reported chronic pain a year later, while 10% of those reporting chronic pain in 2019 no longer had it the following year. But the more pain someone was in 2019, the more likely they were still to be suffering a year later, and the greater their chances of having pain that limited their life and work activities. Older people were more likely to report chronic pain than younger ones, and those without a college degree reported more pain than graduates. Just over half of the study volunteers were women. 54% were ages 18 to 49, and the rest were over 50. Just under 30% were college graduates. The group was roughly reflective of the broader population by races and ethnicity, with 2% American Indian or Alaska Native, 6% Asian, 12% Black, 73% White, and 17% identified as Hispanic. Finally, the U.S. Border Patrol agrees not to set up checkpoints in New Hampshire. The U.S. Border Patrol has agreed in a legal settlement not to set up interior checkpoints in a northern New Hampshire town less than 100 miles from the Canadian border before January 1, 2025. The agreement announced Friday settled a 2020 lawsuit over the use of checkpoints in Woodstock, where the American Civil Liberties Union claimed border agents conducted illegal searches and seizures that led to the arrest of U.S. citizens for violating state laws not related to immigration. And this concludes the reading of the first sections of the Courier Journal for today, Monday, May 22nd. Stay tuned for the Metro section to follow immediately. Your reader has been Rod Brotherton.
This is Radio I Executive Director Tom Lewis, just taking a moment to say thanks. Thanks to the generosity of our supporters, Radio I raised more than $5,300 during Kentucky Gives Day on Tuesday. That equates to a full year of radio service for nearly 180 listeners. A tremendous thank you to our matching donors who were so key in Tuesday's fundraising success. Kentucky Gives Day is the annual online giving challenge for nonprofit organizations in the Commonwealth. If you missed the challenge but would still like to support Radio I, please visit www.radioi.org and click on the Donate tab, or call us at 859-422-6390. Again, thanks.
Now to continue reading from the Courier Journal. For Monday, May 22nd, we turn to the Metro section. Your reader is Vicki Trupiano. We'll read the obituaries first. We read the name, the age, and the location. If you would like further information on any of the obituaries, please call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390. And we'll be glad to read the entire obituary for you. I'll repeat that number at the end of the listings. There are only a few today. John Gordon, 80, Louisville. Bertha Louise Powell Hendren, 90, Cub Run. Jesse Bowles Hort, 96, Louisville. Jean Jones, 94, Carrollton. And Shirley Martin, 95, Lebanon. Again, if you would like any further information about the listings today, call us during the weekdays at 859-422-6390, and we'll be glad to read the entire item to you. Let's begin today's reading on a high note. Jim Beam steps into a new category. Issues its first American single malt whiskey. And this is from Dahlia Gabur of the Louisville Courier-Journal. The James B. Beam Distilling Company is now making single malt whiskey. The Legacy Distillery launched its first American single malt whiskey called Clermont Steep this week. Developed by 8th generation master distiller Freddie Noe, the venture marks the entrance into an emerging category of spirits. Because there's little definition in the American single malt category, Noah developed his own guidelines. Clermont Steep is a 5-year-old liquid distilled and aged in Clermont, Kentucky, and matured in barrels to deliver warm toffee sweetness on the palate without overshadowing the unique bready taste of American barley, according to a news release. As a new venture, crafting Clermont Steep has been one of the toughest challenges I have ever faced in the distillery, and I'm incredibly proud of where we've landed, Noel said in a statement. This American single malt whiskey is smooth, sweet, and incredibly balanced, and it deserves a spot on any whiskey lover's bar cart, right alongside their bourbons and ryes. Noah and his team hand-selected the American malted barley for the mash and used Beam family jug yeast in the natural fermentation process. It's the same yeast that is used in all Beam products, adding a sense of familiarity to every sip, according to the release. The single malt was then distilled on a column still and aged for 5 years in barrels that were toasted, then quickly charred to a char level 1. The launch of Clermont Steep marks a significant milestone in the American whiskey landscape as James B. Beam Distilling Company, the world's largest producer of bourbon, takes a stake in a rapidly growing segment. I'm always looking forward toward the future of American whiskey, and the boundless runway in this category intrigued me, said Noah. We don't just want to participate in American single malt whiskey. We want to help define it for the future of the category. Clermont Steep has a 47% ABV and a suggested retail price of $59.99. The whiskey will be available in select states in-store and on reserve bar beginning in June. For more information, visit clermontsteep.com. You can reach food reporter Dahlia Gabor at dghabour@gannett.com. The next article, constant education, more work needed on sidelines, panelists say. Shortage of athletic trainers at schools was also discussed, and this is from Caleb Wiegandt of the Louisville Courier-Journal. The Courier-Journal hosted a panel discussion Wednesday evening about its recent Safer Sidelines investigation into sudden death in high school sports, furthering the national conversation on the issue. The project revealed how, across the nation and in Kentucky, thousands of high schools don't have gold standard policies in place to protect young athletes. Legislation to mandate such standards is routinely defeated on watered or watered down, and policies and laws that are in place have little enforcement and are often ignored. The panelists included Kentucky High School Athletic Association Commissioner Julian Tackett, State Representative Kim Moser, Republican Taylor Mill, who worked on recent Kentucky sports safety legislation, Alma Maddox, Program Director for the Spalding University Master of Science in Athletic Training Program, and Matthew Mangine Sr., co-founder of the Matthew Mangine Jr. One Shot Foundation, which was created to honor his son, who collapsed during soccer conditioning in June of 2020. Safer Sidelines Project reporter Stephanie Kudzim moderated the panel held at Spalding University. Here are four takeaways from the event. Constant education needed to compensate for high turnover. No state requires all five of the common gold standards of sports medicine for high school sidelines, athletic trainers, venue-specific emergency action plans, EAPs, defibrillators, AEDs, cold water immersion tubs, and wet bulb globe temperature monitors. Tackett described Kentucky as a control state when it comes to implementing sports safety reform, and he said the KHSAA does not have the authority to mandate AEDs for its member schools without legislative approval. Still, when faced with costs needed to establish sports safety procedures, all four panelists agreed that athletic department and school district funds need to be prioritized. While Tackett recognized the costs of AEDs and other gold standards, he noted the already lucrative costs of youth sports participation. Mosher, a nurse and Spalding alumna, echoed Tackett's sentiments and noted that education efforts within the state legislature will need to continue to make up for the lack of medical background in the overall legislative body. We really take issue with the priorities or the lack of priority that some schools put on the safety of our kids, Mosher said. Putting new turf fields or major renovations on hold in favor of safety spending could be the measure that saves lives, the panelists agreed. We need to make sure that we're spending the money on safety before we're even thinking about adding new fields, Maddox said. But equipment is only part of the broader school safety program. Many KHSAA coaches are not school employees, and half of all athletic administrators started after the COVID-19 pandemic, Tackett said. That can lead to a lack of institutional knowledge and creates the need for constant re-education. There were five AEDs on site when Mangine's son, Matthew Jr., died in June of 2020. None was brought to help. Equipment isn't necessarily the issue. What we're talking about here is education, Mangine said. There is a shortage of athletic trainers. The first gold standard of care has always been having an athletic trainer, But the field is not being replenished with new master's level program graduates in Kentucky, especially since the pandemic. Spalding's program head said there was work to be done to address the issue in pay and work conditions for athletic trainers, but noted that the lack of adequacy for SAFE guidelines correlates to the athletic trainer shortage. We need to be valued and supported and given the tools that we need to be successful on the sidelines, Maddox said. And she wants to see budding athletic trainers and emergency medical technicians working together as students to foster a bond that can last as both groups move into the professional world. Traditionally, athletic training programs and emergency medical services have not worked together. They haven't educated together, learned together, and that's an issue, Mannix said. Parents have a role on the front lines of accountability. For Mangine and his wife, Kim, their advocacy through the Matthew Mangine Jr. Foundation has been a part of their grief process since losing their oldest son. Since Buffalo Bills cornerback Damar Hamlin collapsed in a nationally televised game on January 2nd, the crowd of listeners throughout the country has grown. The other panelists agreed that parents like the Mangines have the power to make change at the school level. Mosher said the venue-specific EAP is a good place to start asking questions to a school's administrators. Parents really are in the best position to make this happen, Mosher said. Maddox agrees and thinks parents should not take no for an answer when asking questions about vital safety reforms. Tackett said addressing the issue with the same weight as a child's on-field performance will raise safer sidelines on the list of priorities. As parents, we need to ask these questions, Maddox said. Mangine pointed to the 10 questions that Marty McNair, the father of former University of Maryland defensive lineman Jordan McNair, posed in his book, Can My Child Play? The Questions We Should Have Asked. He agreed that the parent base has the capacity to make change, and so do teachers in using their power to ask for donations for AEDs and other life-saving equipment, often provided by foundations like Mangine's. These questions to ask coaches and administrators can be the first step in ensuring parents like the Mangines and McNair will be in a minority as preventable death in sports is eradicated. We just assumed, and that's something that to this day I think we both regret, Mangine said. Expect more work in the Kentucky legislature on safer guidelines. I'm sorry, safer sidelines. Governor Andy Beshear signed Mosher's House Bill 331 into law in early May. It recommends external automatic defibrillators, AEDs, be in middle and high schools as funds become available. So what's next in the fight for safer sidelines? During the next legislative session, Mosher intends to work for an appropriation to help fund HB 331. Panelists also discussed a possible public-facing database on gold standard and safety training compliance in Kentucky. Tackett said the KHSAA has offered to help the state with this inventory. Mangine echoed Tackett in that peer pressure will be a prime motivator in schools complying with the gold standard. Once one school is doing it, other schools are going to have to follow, Mangine said. The details of how schools will qualify for AED assistance through HB 331 are still being worked out in collaboration with Tackett and the KHSAA. But, Mosher said, a first-come, first-served basis for schools that demonstrate a lack of funding is likely. While that happens, she urged schools to begin their applications as soon as possible. The sooner that a school recognizes that they have this need, the better, Mosher said. Reporter Stephanie Kosdin contributed. Reach reporter Caleb Wiegandt at CWIEGANDT gannett.com. And please forgive any mispronunciations of names on my part. Thank you. Pawn Stars seeks paid extras for its Louisville show. And this is from Ray Johnson of Louisville Courier Journal. Pawn Stars Do America is coming to Louisville and will be hiring local people as extras for episodes of the long-running History Channel TV show. Pawn Stars will hold two June tapings in Kentucky, one in Louisville and one in Taylorsville, as part of the show's Pawn Stars Do America series, according to a release from a show spokesperson. The crew has previously gone to Denver and Savannah, Georgia, which are among their top-rated episodes per IMDb. People 18 and older can bring a cool and unique item to get the chance to sell it to the cast for cash on the spot, the release said. Attendees will also get the chance to mingle on set, watch the cast work, and see the show getting filmed. The crew will tape for 3 days in each spot, and no acting experience is required. Fun, everyday people are encouraged to apply. Those who get selected and can attend a full day as an extra will get $150 and a meal, and days start around 9 a.m. Applications for an extra spot can be submitted online. Those who can only attend part of the day but still want an opportunity to sell an item can apply for free tickets. Pawn Stars will be in Louisville from June 13th to the 15th and in Taylorsville from June 21st to the 23rd. You can contact reporter Ray Johnson at rnjohnson@gannett.com. We have some time left, so I'm going to read an opinion that was contributed today. And this is from Pesha Edison. Pesha, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. The DOG investigation validated what we've said for years. When will our voices be heard? When will Mayor Greenberg listen to us? In May 2020, my city came alive in unity and in pain, asking once again to be heard, sparked by the unjust murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. Hundreds of Louisville residents gathered in peaceful demonstrations to protest police violence against Black people. In our collective frustration, we banded together on streets and sidewalks for months to demand change. Instead, we were met with the very violence we were protesting. I attended many of the demonstrations that summer to protect and support my community. I thought of my daughters and their generation's futures. I wanted to be there to make sure that everyone was safe. Each day, LMPD responded with military-type force and intimidation, terrorizing peaceful protesters. As a board member of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racial and Political Repression, I worked with other members to bring in supplies to help treat pain and injuries from tear gas, pepper balls, and chemical munitions. But I found myself and other board members becoming victims of that same violence. I know what happened to protesters. I was there. One night, I watched from a parking lot as folks of all ages, including children, gathered near Injustice Square Park. Two friends joined me, one in a wheelchair, as the group marched and chanted. I felt the tear gas before I saw it. I squeezed my eyes shut as the chemicals burned, but quickly fell to the ground, unable to see, unable to breathe. I crawled on my hands and knees, the sounds of screams, cries, and chaos in the distance. Earlier that day, officers were caught on cell phone cameras destroying jugs of water and milk, essential first aid items for protesters exposed to tear gas. Instances like this played out on repeat night after night. These recurrent scenes still haunt me. Over the last 2 years, the Alliance has attempted to make calls for reform to the city of Louisville to no avail. Nearly 2 years later, many of us are still feeling the physical and emotional effects of the violence we encountered that summer and very little has done to address our concerns. We relive these painful memories once again when the U.S. Department of Justice issued a scathing report last month outlining the many varied ways that LMPD violates our rights. Citing the 2020 protests, the DOJ's investigation revealed that LMPD has shown a pattern of practice of excessive and indiscriminate force against peaceful protesters, violating the First and Fourth Amendments. The DOJ found that LMPD repeatedly used unlawful and excessive force against peaceful protesters, often not only failing to de-escalate situations, but actually engaging in behavior that escalated these interactions and using indiscriminate force without individualized and adequate justifications. The report also raises deeply troubling findings of racial discrimination and bias by LMPD officers that echo the racial discrimination that Black people in Louisville experienced at the hands of the LMPD throughout the 2020 uprising and continue to experience each day. The DOJ's finding, while infuriating, were not surprising for those of us who live in Louisville. These findings echoed what our communities live with and witness every day, and confirm what we have been saying for years. Despite all that we have suffered to make our voices heard, the city of Louisville still isn't listening. In fact, Louisville ignored our calls for reform for so long that we sued. The Alliance joined as an organizational plaintiff in a lawsuit, Scott versus Louisville. LMPD's use of indiscriminate force at protests must end. Our demand is simple. End LMPD's use of indiscriminate force at protests so that the people of Louisville can safely make themselves heard in the months and years to come as we continue to fight for change within and without LMPD and begin the difficult work of healing. After the DOJ came to town to report its findings, Mayor Greenberg announced his intent to listen and work with Washington to bring about change. He acknowledged that Department of Justice's pattern or practice report paints a very painful picture of our past. We tried to be optimistic about his goals and were open to settling our lawsuit. But so far, Mayor Greenberg has chosen instead to join his predecessor in fighting to keep tear gas in LMPD's hands. The city has spent nearly $1 million defending their ability to use force against crowds of peaceful protesters just for exercising their right to speak out. The exact use of force that the Department of Justice found violated the First and Fourth Amendments, and for which a jury in Colorado awarded 12 protesters $14 million for their suffering. If Mayor Greenberg wants us to move forward as a community, empty words are not enough. We cannot continue to wait for meaningful change. Mayor Greenberg must meet us at the negotiating table and start centering the demands of the people of Louisville. Mayor Greenberg, when will you listen to us? Pesha Edison is the academic instructional coach at Waller Williams Environmental and chair of the Jefferson County Teachers Association Black Caucus. She also serves as the treasurer of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Back to the weather and things to come. Here's an article about making vacation plans, if you think. When is hurricane season? Here's when hurricane season starts and what to expect in 2023. And this is from Doyle Rice of USA Today. It's almost here. The 2023 Atlantic hurricane season is on our doorstep. Though tropical storms and hurricanes can form year-round, most brew during the six-month Atlantic hurricane season, which officially runs from June 1st to November 30th each year, In fact, 97% of all tropical cyclones in the Atlantic form during this season. Tropical cyclone is an umbrella term that includes tropical storms and hurricanes. A tropical storm gets a name when its sustained winds reach 39 miles per hour. A tropical storm becomes a hurricane when its sustained winds reach 74 miles per hour. The Atlantic Hurricane Basin includes storms that form in the Atlantic Ocean, Caribbean Sea, and Gulf of Mexico. Based on the 30-year climate period from 1991 to 2020, an average Atlantic hurricane season has 14 named storms, of which 7 become hurricanes. Of these 7 hurricanes, 3 are classified as major hurricanes, Category 3, 4, or 5 on the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale. When do Atlantic hurricanes typically form, and what are hurricane season months? Although the official season lasts from June to November, the primary time of year for hurricanes to form is midsummer to mid-autumn, specifically June to October. That's because the meteorological ingredients necessary for hurricane formation are all available at that time of year. Ingredients include ocean water of at least 80 degrees, a tropical atmosphere that produces plenty of thunderstorms, a lack of wind shear, and a substantial amount of large-scale spin. The first named storm typically forms in mid to late June. The first hurricane tends to form in early to mid-August, and the first major hurricane forms in late August or early September. The statistical peak of the Atlantic hurricane season is September 10th. What about Eastern Pacific hurricanes? When is the Eastern Pacific hurricane season? The Eastern Pacific hurricane season runs from May 15th to November 30th. The Eastern Pacific Basin extends from Mexico and Central America and westward to 140 degrees west longitude in the Pacific Ocean. In the Eastern Pacific, the peak in activity is late August, but this peak is less pronounced than the peak in the Atlantic. Relatively high levels of activity in the Eastern Pacific tend to spread out over a larger portion of the season than in the Atlantic, and most tropical cyclones occur from late June to early October. Based on a 30-year climate period from 1991 to 2020, an average Eastern Pacific hurricane season has 15 named storms, 8 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes. The first named storm typically forms in early to mid-June. The first hurricane tends to form in late June, and the first major hurricane forms in mid-July. Will the 2023 hurricane season be active? Forecasters, in general, predict a near to slightly below average year for hurricanes in the Atlantic. That's in part because of the influence of an expected El Niño, which tends to reduce Atlantic hurricane activity. Top forecasters from Colorado State University predict that 13 tropical storms will form in the Atlantic, of which 6 will become hurricanes. But El Niño tends to boost hurricane activity in the Eastern Pacific Basin, so the west coast of Mexico could see an unusually active season. The National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration and the National Hurricane Center contributed to this article. This concludes excerpts from the Courier-Journal for Monday, May 22nd. Your reader has been Vicki Trupiano. Please stay tuned for continued programming on Radio I.